Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
So your mentor, I can call Lou your one of your mentors, right?
He is, yes.
And so he's brought on this, I mean, it's one of the most high-profile cases ever.
Right.
And he is going into it with the idea, like you said, well, this should be pretty simple. Mm-hmm. But he's also going into it with the idea that they want to know the truth. At mm-hmm. some point, he's hit... like with a brick wall.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember having any conversations with him about his frustration and what he felt that he needed to do?
We had many discussions. And, you know, I don't know if it was a brick wall immediately, but he definitely came across evidence that didn't support the Ramseys did it. And the more he got into it, the more evidence supported the intruder theory as he developed it. And then I think after, it was more than a couple of weeks, it might have been a month or two, I think that's when he realized that there was a brick wall, that he was being stonewalled. And when he would bring up information to the Boulder police, it would be dismissed or they would try to... exclude the evidence through some rationale. For example, when Lou pointed out in the crime scene photos taken that morning of the basement with that window standing wide open and the suitcase standing upright below it, and there's also what Lou thought was to be a black scuff mark on the wall. So when he's pointing to the crime scene photos that Boulder police crime scene technicians had taken, and he's showing the detectives that is evidence a forced entry. One of the first things the Boulder police said is, "Oh no, nobody could have gotten in that window." Well, Lou's frustrated because he's trying to explain. Well, that's how JonBenet's dad got into the home when he left his keys in the house, and so what Lou did is he had himself videotaped crawling in and out of that window. And Lou, I think at the time was, I don't know, he was always in good shape. I think he was probably mid-60s at the time, but. He would show that, you know, I can get in and out of that window here, watch. And he had himself videotaped and then showed that videotape to the Boulder detectives. And they would just ignore it. And then they would, you know, go on, you know, to something else. And Lou said, that's what was really so frustrating was you would confront them with physical evidence and then they would dismiss it. A good example is the foreign DNA that was under the little girl's fingernails on the crotch of her panties. And then in 2008, it was also determined to be below the waistband of her, of the long johns that she was wearing for pajama bottoms. And so when Lou pointed out that not only does that exclude the any members of the Ramsey family, it gives us something to work with because it's male, so we can stop looking at women being involved, unless there, you know, is a conspiracy here or someone else involved. But he said we need to find out who's the male who left that foreign DNA on her clothing and on her body. And so what the Boulder police would do is they would say, you know, that could be anything. You know, that might have been, casual contact, DNA that was, from trace or touch DNA that was left, for casual contact. And what Lou would say was, well, that makes no sense. He said, I don't know what you're thinking, but anytime that there's unknown male DNA found on the crotch of a little girl's panties, that's not, casual touch. That's evidence of something that's really wrong. But then it's the same. It matches the genetic markers are the same that's underneath the fingernails. And when the genetic material, this tissue that is forcibly under her fingernails that was found at the autopsy, that's evidence of her clawing and scratching her assailant, trying to breathe. She's fighting for her life. And they just, no, that's not what that means. And Lou just would just be just beside himself. He says, I can't understand how you can, just simply try to just dismiss this evidence because it doesn't fit with your theory that the Ramseys have done it.
Did you ever meet Ollie Gray?
Oh, yes. I knew Ollie very well. In fact, when I was a sheriff, he came to work for me for a few months as my comptroller. No, knew him very, very well.
Could you tell our listeners, most of our listeners will not know who he is. Could you tell our listeners who Ollie Gray was and his in relation to the Ramsey case?
Yes. Ollie was a friend of Lou's as well. And there was another person that is very important here too, John St. Augustine. And when John ran after Lou had resigned from the Boulder DA's office, he continued working the case for himself, but on his own time, his own expense. But he didn't want it to look like he was working for the Ramseys. So he would never take any money from the Ramseys. And he wanted to objectively investigate the case, not at the direction of the Ramseys. So when the Ramseys said, well, we really need to hire some competent private investigators because Boulder police obviously were not going to be able to clear this on their own. And so Lou recommended Ollie Gray and John St. Augustine. John had also worked for me at the sheriff's office and a bright young investigator. Ollie has since passed on. John is still around. But they worked the case as private investigators for the Ramsey family for some time, maybe for a year or two. And I know that and Ollie did have a law enforcement background from California and new investigations, was a very competent PI. And I know he stayed in touch, and John St. Augustine stayed in touch with Lou, and they had frequent discussions. And I don't know specifically what Lou would have given them or received from them, but I do know Lou was very good about sharing information, and particularly if it fit into a profile or a suspect or person of interest that the Ramseys private investigators were pursuing. So I know Lou was very supportive and hoping that Ollie and John would have some success.
But it's my understanding Ollie Gray was the only individual in all these decades of this case dragging on and on. He's the only person that ever worked for both sides of the table, correct? He worked with Boulder for a while and then decided to go and work with the Ramseys. And while working with the Ramseys, it's my understanding he told John Ramsey immediately, look, if I find anything that suggests that you or Patsy or Burke, that somebody inside the Ramsey household did this, I'm turning it into Boulder immediately. Is that correct?
Correct, except for one exception. Ollie never worked with the Boulder Police Department or the Sheriff's Office directly. He did work with Lou and I at the El Paso County Sheriff's Office, but when he was hired by the Ramseys, he had left the DA's office. He had already been retired from law enforcement agency in California when I hired him to come into the sheriff's office. But you're right. Not only he, but John St. Augustine and Lou, had they ever come across any evidence that, you know, that suggested any of the Ramseys were involved, they would have definitely turned that over. That was the kind of people that they were. They wouldn't sit on that, even if they were employed by the Ramseys. They would have resigned that position and then turned in the information. Ollie was very ethical that way.
What are the keys to this investigation as far as getting it solved? The evidence, I know that you point to five very vital pieces of evidence that support Lou Smith's intruder theory. Could you take us through those five vital pieces of evidence?
Happy to. The first one is the paracord, and the second one is the black duct tape. The third one is the stun gun. All those three items are still valid, with this exception that after 27 years, whether or not we can find the paracord, you know, that the bindage was removed for, or the parent roll from the duct tape or the stun gun at this point in the possession of the killer, is very doubtful. The fourth item of evidence that Lou always talked about that supported his intruder theory was the high-tech boot print. And what Lou did not know, and I did not know this until after the book had been published, one of the other team members that's on our Smith family team, Kurt Pillard, came across a report in a Boulder Police supplemental report that got released after Lou's passing in 2010. And this lab report talked about at least one, or might have been more than one, Boulder police officers who were in the crime scene did admit to having high-tech boots. What Lou didn't know is that boot print very easily could have belonged to one of the first responders, with the Boulder police. So we don't put a lot of credibility onto that boot print. But the most important piece of evidence, the fifth piece of evidence that Lou always believed would be what solved this case, was the unknown male DNA that's on three pieces of the clothing, two pieces of clothing, the long johns, the underwear, and then under her fingernails and the scrapings that came from the autopsy. Our team, one of the things that we've been working with is the genetic markers, the DNA markers that Lou left in his case report, supplemental reports, investigative notes that were passed down to his family that our team has had access to, that those three locations, the DNA genetic markers do fit. Now, we didn't have a complete set. I think there's at least 14, maybe 15 genetic markers now, but it is sufficient to have it into the CODIS, the combined DNA information system that the FBI maintains. One other piece of positive news, a couple things just to leave the interview on an up note, a hopeful note that our team, and I think the Ramsey family also finds some comfort, is that the DNA technology has evolved so significantly in the last 27 years that law enforcement agencies are clearing cold cases that are 20, 25, 30 years old by going back to the original evidence, the original article of evidence, and retesting that using more modern DNA technologies. And what has been so helpful is that what we used to have to look at when you did DNA analysis, maybe, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, it was being measured in nanograms, which is a very small, minute amount. But today, the technology is able, and I'm not a DNA expert, but it is known that the DNA can be measured now in picograms, which are significantly smaller amounts. And so that's highly encouraging. The second part of that is that the databases every year keep growing exponentially, whether it's law enforcement databases or public or private DNA databases. And that's how a lot of cases that you all know about have been solved, like the Golden State Killer. They didn't actually have the killer's DNA. They were able to get into the familial DNA and found a relative, I think it was a niece who lived in another state, and her DNA showed that the killer's DNA, that they shared a common ancestor. And that's what we hope, and that was one of the reasons to get the book out, was to encourage law enforcement agencies to continue to do that. The other encouraging thing, just within the last few months, is that the Boulder police have released statements, and the Boulder District Attorney have made comments that the case is being looked at, the evidence is being reevaluated, and using more modern technologies. The District Attorney in Boulder, the now DA, Michael Daugherty, he even commented in the news recently that the FBI are also assisting. And that's very encouraging because the FBI has some very bright people. They have access to some cutting edge technologies and DNA. And of course, they maintain the CODIS, the National DNA Database. So what we're really hopeful in going into this holiday season is that there's never been a better time for this case, the JonBenet Ramsey case, to be solved than now. That I think the family feels this too, the Smith family team, that we hope the Boulder police and the law enforcement agencies that are around them now are doing everything that they can to take an objective look at the physical evidence using modern technologies for DNA analysis. And hopefully that will identify the person responsible for the crime, which in some people's mind will be the only way for the Ramsey family ever to be removed from that umbrella of suspicion.
Yeah, and if it gets solved, it grants Lou's dying wish. Because I don't think people understand how, and I think when you were, if you use the word obsessed, that sometimes people use that as a bad thing. He's on his deathbed, and his family wants to talk about good times, and there's video footage that I've seen where he's like, no, you guys need to listen to me. And he's going page by page in his case files to explain to him what each page means. Mm-hmm. And he set up that list of people that I know that they've been going through and trying to get DNA and testing through that list. So as much as you want justice for this little girl and her family and for that community, I really believe if there ever is an arrest, that Lou is directly responsible for that.
You're so right, because I would never have written the book had it not been for Lou. And not only do we want justice for JonBenet, and of course, on a personal note, I'd really like to see Lou, his theory be proven right, and the family the Ramsey family being able to enjoy a regular Christmas and not have to worry about this, if that's possible. Our Smith family team, we talk about this all the time too. We meet probably once a month or every 5 or 6 weeks. We've got our list from Lou, of our top 20 people that we continue to work on. And what we would love to do as a team is to be able to close all of our investigation down too, and just live a normal life. Like everybody else, this has taken a lot of time and energy, and we had all made such a commitment to Lou that we just can't back away from that. It was a really emotional time for all of us, and for Lou when he was diagnosed with cancer, when it returned and admitted to hospice, He was able to go home for a couple of weeks, and he had a visiting nurse. And I know that's when he put a lot more of the case in, organized it a little bit better for us, because he knew he wasn't going to get around to many of those leads. But his last several weeks in hospice, as he continued, every time I would go see him every couple of days, you know, he was slipping a little further and a little further. And the last 3 days before he passed, he was pretty much in a coma. We weren't able to have any communication two-way. I'd sit and talk to him and hold his hands. But when he was able to talk, you know, we'd talk about the good times and laugh about things and our friends and joke. And I remember he said, you know, one of the good things about hospice is they let you eat or drink, you know, anything you want, even though we didn't have much of an appetite at the end. But he'd say, yeah, I want ice cream, and it's, you know, in the middle of the morning or whatever, or beer. I know I walked in one time, and I don't know if the nurses knew this, but he had a six-pack of beer that one of the detectives had brought in. So we enjoyed another beer together, last beer. But the conversations always would come around. He'd say, now, don't forget boot man, and say, and don't forget so-and-so, and remember to look at this, and don't forget about the evidence. And those were our last conversations. It was foremost on his mind. And you're right, Nick. I don't think obsessed is the right word. I think it was just driven or dedicated. I think, you know, people probably have a hard time, you know, grasping that, but Lou was such a unique man and such a consummate professional, and he'd never believed he worked for, you know, the police department or, you know, Sergeant so-and-so or Captain so-and-so. He always said, I work for the victim. And I think that was really his take on the Ramsey case. He didn't work for John or Patsy or any of the Ramsey family. He worked for John Binet. That was who he worked for.
And Lou, one of his dying wishes was that this case would finally be solved. And we also have, go back in time, Patsy Ramsey on her deathbed asking Lou to find out who did this.
Yes, that was a conversation that Lou shared with me. When Patsy was on her deathbed in hospice, Lou flew down to Atlanta to see her one last time. And part of that, you know, he told me later, was to see if she wanted to give a dying confession. Not that he ever thought she'd ever confess to that, but he wanted to make sure he closed that door. And so she didn't give dying confession. She gave the opposite. She gave him the charge, you know, to continue pursuing this killer. Don't give up. And that really did motivate Lou. Not that he needed additional motivation, but I think I know that was an emotional trip when he went to visit her that last time. And when Lou was in hospice, John Ramsey came and visited Lou. And that was, John Ramsey told me, he said, I tried to go in to give Lou encouragement and cheer him up, but he said it turned out to be the other way around. Yeah, Lou was quite a guy.
Tell everybody about the JBR Schmidt family team. I know you've talked about it just a little bit, but really tell us what that is. What is the objective? What is the strategy that you're employing to try to reach those goals?
Great question. And thanks for bringing that in, Nick. When Lou passed away in 2010, he had all of his investigative notes. He had put together a spreadsheet, 883 entries on this spreadsheet, 53 columns. He had a PowerPoint presentation that had grown to 632 slides, and he showed me this as it's evolving, and he had all of his investigative notes and crime scene photos and autopsy reports, and he had everything so organized that when you'd walk into his home, he said, hey, I want to show you this. And so we were very familiar with what he had put together. And then when he passed away, all of his wife, Barb, had already passed away from cancer a few years before. So all of Lou's investigative notes and his computer and his case file, all was part of his estate that got passed down to his four children. And within about a month of his passing, his middle daughter, Cindy, called me and she said, "Hey, John," she said, "you know, hey, we've got all the dad's, you know, investigative notes and his spreadsheet and everything." And he said, "You know, we're going to assemble a team and do what dad said and continue working this case because we don't believe Boulder will ever solve this on their own. And Lou left us with all of this information to work with. Will you come and be a part of the team?" And before I could answer yes or no, because I'd retired from the sheriff's office and I was working for Lockheed Martin doing a lot of travel. But before I could say yes or no, she said, "And Dave Spencer's already agreed to be a part of it," because she knew how close Dave and I were to one another as well as to Lou. And so when she told me Dave Spencer was on board already, I said, I'm in, because I knew how organized Dave was and what a competent detective he was, as well as a private investigator when he retired from the PD. So since 2010, the Smit family, JBR, JonBenet Ramsey, JBR team, we've been meeting at least once a month or maybe every 6 weeks, probably an average of 10 times a year. And what we do is we go through our top 20 list. We've gone out on more than a dozen cases of persons of interest left from Lou, where we'll try to obtain that person's DNA and submit it to the lab. We pay for the DNA analysis on our own. After a few years, the first few years, we just had to pass the hat because we didn't have any money. But after a few years, Cindy did put together a GoFundMe account. And we had budgeted at that time for our top 20, we were averaging about $5,000 per test. And that included the travel to fly out to a hotel, or if we had to stay somewhere, and the lab analysis, that was a good average. So we thought to get our top 20, we would need $100,000. So that was our GoFundMe account target. Last I looked, I think we were up to like 62 or 63,000. And that might be one thing we could do, Nick and Captain, is if I send you the link, maybe you can, you know, make that available, you know, to your listeners. There's three different accounts. Only one of them is connected to our team. And so I want to make sure everybody gets the right one. But we've had some very generous donations, and you can look on there and you can see, you know, who's donated and how much. The Ramsey family, Jeff Ramsey's contributed several times. That's John's brother. One of the neat things we had was a lady who had read my book that I'd never met. She called me and she said, "John, I'm really impressed with your book, and we really want to see your Smit family team succeed." And she said, "I'm prepared today to make a $10,000 donation." And I sent her the link, you know, and you kind of think, you know, is this a scam, you know, or are they going to want my, you know, account number or whatever? But she was true to her word. Within hours, we had a $10,000 donation from an anonymous source. And that's helped a lot. And I think we have several thousand dollars in there now, but I know the Ramsey family have said, you know, "Hey, if you guys start running low, you let us know and we'll contribute." And sometimes we've gone out and actually approached somebody who was on the list. And a lot of these names are known, you know, they've been in other people's books. And so we'll go up to somebody and contact them and say, "Hey, you know, you were brought up as a potential suspect, you know, back in 97 or 98. And if they were falsely accused, we say, you know, we can give you an opportunity to clear yourself if you want, and we'll pay for it." And so sometimes we've had a couple of persons of interest willingly give us a DNA. It's usually just an oral swab on a Q-tip that we submit to the lab. And a couple of times, you know, they kind of hesitated, and we said, "Well, if we gave you $300 or $500, would that work better for you?" So we have paid for a few DNA samples, and when we get a sample off of discarded DNA or whatever, we kind of hold our breath, you know, hoping that this is the one. And it takes a painful amount of time to get the analysis back, and so we've had many disappointments that that we sent in somebody that could be a strong person that was on Lou's list and it comes back negative. But I keep hearing my former partner's voice in my ear saying, okay, now we know who didn't do it. Let's move on to the next one, next man up.
It was almost the perfect crime. Everyone was distracted, their attention elsewhere. Stacks of cold hard cash sitting on the table unguarded. Who wouldn't be tempted to slowly reach their hand out and steal a pile of Monopoly money from the banker? Monopoly is one of those games that can bring out everyone's most devious selves. And Monopoly Go takes that gleeful mischievousness to your phone in a wildly popular twist on the classic game that you can play throughout your day, anywhere, anytime. Collect rent from friends on iconic properties. Bankrupt them by pulling a heist on their vault. And Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with friends to unlock big prizes and try to top the leaderboards. Whether you're helping out your friends or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is an absolute blast. Download it now free on the App Store or Google Play.
Do you want to set your child up for success? Of course you do. That's why you need to check out IXL Learning today. IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids covering math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed to help them really understand and master topics in a fun way. It's powered by advanced algorithms. IXL gives the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. There's one site for all kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Kids could use it at home on their computer or on an app on your phone or a tablet. No more grading those worksheets. IXL grades everything for you. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. I love recommending IXL Learning. Kids can learn at home or on the go. And all my friends and family that are using it absolutely love it because it's so easy to set up and so easy to use. And even the kids that I've recommended it to their parents have told me, hey, Captain, thank you. I was having problems in math and my parents couldn't help me, but IXL could. Do you want to get your kids back on track or do you just want to get your kids ahead? Do so with IXL Learning. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And True Crime Garage listeners get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/garage. Visit IXL.com/garage to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price. Check out IXL.com/garage today.
Have you ever thought about why your wireless bill is so damn expensive? It's all just radio waves. And how much can radio waves really cost? It seems like Big Wireless all got together and decided $100 a month. Now, thanks to Mint Mobile, you have a choice. For a limited time, all phone plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plan's jaw-dropping monthly bills and unexpected overages. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. So ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited-time deal and get premium wireless for just $15 a month. I love Mint Mobile. They have great quality. They have wonderful service. I love saving money. Put them together, and I'm getting great quality, great service, a wonderful phone plan for only $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options and more than 60 add-ons every week. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. Factor's ready-to-eat meals are on the table in 2 minutes. Eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savor the good stuff. Customize your weekly meals with as much or as little as you need. Pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. They're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Day Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. I am always on the go. I'm rather busy. And grabbing a quick meal, for me, used to mean eating the bad stuff. But I've switched to Factor. Now I simply grab a Factor meal from my refrigerator, heat, and then I am enjoying a delicious meal in just 2 minutes. And it's not loaded with the bad stuff. Head to factormeals.com/TrueCrimeGarage50 and use code TrueCrimeGarage50. To get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month, that's code TrueCrimeGarage50 at factormeals.com/TrueCrimeGarage50. 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. So you have people that you've eliminated. You have a top 20 persons of interest list, and these are lists that you at one time shared with Boulder PD, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've shared that list in confidence. Then when we've eliminated somebody on our top 20, we go back to Lou's spreadsheet and we take the next most likely person and bump them up into the top 20. Lou left it, his 883 entry spreadsheet in four tiers, tier one, two, three, four. Tier one is who he thought needed the most look. And he had eliminated probably over 100 people. Well, maybe not that many. Anyway, he had eliminated a number of people before he passed on. And then our team has eliminated and reprioritized. I think last count was like 123 other names. Some of them, you know, was a name that was brought up as a potential suspect. And then once you look at them, you can say, well, it can't be this guy because, you know, he died in, you know, 95, or this guy was in prison since 93, or whatever. So you can eliminate some without doing the DNA. But the ones that remain, we look at, oh, who was most likely being Boulder? Was there some motive? We also, because of Lou, had access to the Boulder DNA lab reports that showed, you know, who had been eliminated previously. So we were able to, you know, exclude some of those. But when we gave our top 20 to Boulder police, we've done this a couple of times, and the Boulder DA, we said, you know, if there's somebody on this list that you've already eliminated, could you please let us know? That way we're not bothering them, or we're not, you know, wasting our time and money. And our first meeting with the DA is he agreed to do that. And then the second meeting, 6 months later, they refused to do that. But we still keep sending them the names that we've eliminated. We let them know who we're looking at. But so far, as Commander Trujillo told me going in, that, you know, this is a one-way street. We're not sharing any information with you. Tom Trujillo was the commander of the homicide unit for years. He'd been on the original crime scene. And one time was a friend of mine, but Tom was disciplined along with five other Boulder detectives in December of last year for not thoroughly investigating their cases. And he was removed as the captain of detectives and put into patrol on midnights. And then these other detectives either left or were disciplined for not thoroughly investigating their cases. The Boulder police public information officer put out a statement that had nothing to do with the JonBenet Ramsey case, but I always maintained it had everything to do with the JonBenet Ramsey case, because unfortunately that was the culture that Lou bumped up to in 96 and 97, was they just were not interested in, or didn't know how, or didn't have the right supervision, you know, to thoroughly investigate their cases. So there is a new captain, commander, there's a new detectives, there's new leadership, there's a different police chief than that was there back when this happened. So we're our team, our Smith family team, we're continuing to meet and pursue our top 20 list, but we're also wishing Boulder Police, the FBI, whoever's involved in this case, Colorado Bureau Investigation, much success, because we would just love to see the case solved for the family and be able to close this case once and for all. I should also mention one of the other motivations is, like with the Heather Dawn Church case, is the likelihood of this killer, as violent as a crime as this is, that this being a one-off is minimal. You know, this is the type of a violent pedophile that, you know, just doesn't start off, you know, at that level of violence. You know, they increase their MO, modus operandi, they fine tune that, they get more and more violent, more and more creative. And so the likelihood that there's not victims before and most likely after this murder is minimal. So I think, like with the Heather Dawn Church case, whenever this person's identified, there's a strong likelihood that there'll be a pattern of violent offenses. So we hope that it's solved, not just to get justice for JonBenet and prove Lou right, but more importantly is to get this violent pedophile off the street, if he's still out there.
Do you have, and I know we don't want to get too specific about names here on either one of your lists, but as far as your persons of interest go, and you have a top 20, Lou had a spreadsheet that had many more names on it than that. Are all of these persons identified, like, or any of them referenced and not identified by name?
All of ours are identified by name in our top 20. There are several with Lou's entries. When you look at the 883, you'll see a nickname, or you'll see someone referred to as a landscaper, for example, but or a plumber who had been in the house 3 months before or something. And Lou was convinced that the killer had access to the home before the night of the murder. It just seems like knew where things were located. And Lou believed that he probably even went through that window in the basement before that night. So Lou was looking very carefully at other people who had access to the home. And so there were a few people on his list that didn't have a name, but were referenced to in some capacity. A good example, most people know who followed this case know the reference to Santa Claus. That person was later identified, and through DNA, that person was eliminated as a potential suspect. But yes, to answer your question, there are some that are either known as a nickname or partial name or some tagline.
Do you recall if the Running Man is on that list?
Oh, I remember something about the Running Man. I'd have to go back and look.
Yeah, the Running Man has always kind of spooked me a bit, and I don't know that there's much known about him other than one or two persons saying that they thought they saw a tall, slender man running in the area at some point that day.
Yeah, I know our teams, it goes back a few years. We did spend some time on this Running Man theory, but I don't know that that was ever tracked down or identified. I'll have to look into that. Good thought.
Captain, do you have any last questions.
I got like a million.
There's only 100,000 questions in this case, but Mr. Anderson, you had a, correct me if I'm wrong, but with the, you know, I read the book months and months ago because it came out early this year. And I believe you said in the book that you have a, do you have a website or somewhere that people can go to view more information about the case?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. I should have mentioned that earlier. My publisher for Lou and JonBenet is Wild Blue Press, and they have a website. And what I did, with permission of the of Lou's family, is in the book, the hardcover and the softcover, I have 36 slides that from Lou's original presentation that are printed in the book, in the middle of the book, kind of like photos. In my audio book, obviously, since you wouldn't have, you know, access to those photos, my publisher offered to host the photos that I wanted to include on their website, wildbluepress.com. And if you look up my book, Lou and JonBenet, instead of doing the same 36 photos that are in the book, we picked 20 other photos that are not in the book, crime scene photos. So if you compare the two, that's 56 slides of Lou's that he put together. They're all his notes. And I think that gives people a really good overview of the crime scene, the autopsy. Nothing overly gory or bloody there, but there are a few autopsy photos, like, for example, the stun gun marks. And so if anybody's interested in looking at the slides that Lou put together, I think that the wildbluepress.com is very good for that. And then they've also put together a couple of good, let's see, there's been some blogs and some other things that they've done a good job with. And what we'll do, Nick or Captain, if one of you, when this is finished and you've put it out, if you'll send me a link, I'll get that added to the website for Wild Blue Press as well.
Another thing that was really incredible with your book that is just, I mean, there's no shortage of books about the JonBenet case, but this is the right. only book that I've seen that features the floor diagrams, the layout of the complete house, the first floor, second floor, third floor. It has every room of the house and the basement included. So I thought that was, if you don't understand the crime scene, there's no way to understand the case. And so to include stuff like that in a case that's been so convoluted over the years, and in a case where people are so heavily charged up about their theory or thoughts of who did it, but there's still a lot of information out there that most people just don't know. So thank you for including those diagrams in your book.
You're very welcome. And that's a very good observation. And I can't take credit for that, because that's vintage Lou Smith. He's the one who put together those four diagrams using his computer. And I think that shows why this book is unique, is because Lou had access to the crime scene personally. I mean, he went there and he took those measurements to make those diagrams, and to see how, you know, where was the evidence found? Where is this blue suitcase at? Where is this baseball bat at? And I think what makes the book unique, and I realized that I was in the unique position to get those out there, was because I was one of the few people that had access to Lou's spreadsheet and his case file, his notes, thanks to his family. So yes, I think that is what's different from other books, because a lot of the other authors, you know, studied, you know, it was in the newspaper, might've gotten copies of reports, but Lou was actually there. He was in the crime scene. I've been to the Ramsey, former Ramsey home several times, but I was never inside. But Lou was many, many times. So he had an intimate understanding of the crime scene inside and out. One other thing that, and thank you for the nice compliments about my book. Any book, as you guys know, is a team effort. And one of the things that I'm most proud of on the book is the cover. And one of the few requests I made of my publisher, Wild Blue Press, was I had two photos that I had one of Lou, and that was the first day in the sheriff's office, January 10th, 1995, when we were both sworn in. I became the sheriff. He became my captain detective. So I wanted that photo of Lou, one of my favorite photos on the cover. And then the photo of JonBenet was one of my favorite photos. And I had a different photo that came out of Lou's case file of her in her kindergarten class. And I sent them to as a mock-up of the cover to her dad. And I said, hey, John, these are the this is kind of what the cover is looking like. And you know, I did not want a glamour shot. There were too many books out there with that. And Lou never saw JonBenet as a beauty queen. He always saw her as a little innocent little kindergartner, as she was. And so when I sent the other mock-up of the book cover to her dad, he sent me a nice little email, and he said, I like that photo too. But he said, John, could you use this one instead? He said it was JonBenet's first day of kindergarten, and he said it's one of my favorite photos. And Patsy took that photo right before she put her in the car and took her to her first day of kindergarten. And it's a neat little photo because it shows her with her little backpack slung over her shoulder, and she's got a little plastic apple that has treats or something for the kids. I don't actually know what's in there. And then her little dog, Jock, and it's a cute little outfit that I'm sure Patsy picked out to wear for the first day of kindergarten. But I think it gives you a real look at two important photos, two people who never met and are forever linked in history through this case.
Is there something, as you guys have looked through, you know, it's been a team effort to look through Lou's case files. Is there something that you feel like he got wrong?
What a good question. Well, certainly the high-tech boot, we've had to take, you know, a step back on that. Because I remember talking to him specifically about that boot print. And he said, yeah, he said none of the Boulder police, had been confirmed to wear high-tech boots. They've been asked. They didn't. Let's see. So I'm convinced he just didn't have the right information. I can't really say he was wrong on that. Let's see. No, I think, I can't think of anything else. I think it's the opposite. I think the more and more our team, you know, have gone through the lab analysis, the reports, the more we realize that he was spot on. A good example of that was the DNA, the initial reports had under like the fingernails, and I can't remember the exact numbers. I think there were like six genetic markers on the two hands, left and right, initially. And I think there were like nine that came off of the underwear. Then they were the same six or ones that were on the nine. And so Lou was convinced, you know, that this was from the same person. The 2008 analysis with the long johns. Now here's a different article of clothing, and it gives us, I think there was 11 or 12 genetic markers on that one. There were more anyway, but it was the same six that were in the fingernails that were on the long johns, the same nine that were on the underwear. So what it's done, Nick, is it's kind of done the opposite. Every time we get a little bit more physical evidence, a little more corroborating evidence, information, it really substantiates that Lou was right all along.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people that have looked into this case after Lou, they nitpick things like where they go, just like the window. I think what Lou was able to prove is, because there was a lot of speculation that the Ramseys would leave doors unlocked, or people that worked for the Ramseys would say not only were the doors unlocked, but there would be a jar, and there was, it's such a big house that, you know, John Ramsey would come downstairs and have to start shutting windows and shutting doors and locking things because the kids would just leave things open. But I also think he proved, like, well, even if there was locked doors and locked windows, here's a way that the intruder could get in.
Right.
And I think that's where I think people nitpick. They go, well, there's no proof that somebody went through there. But it's like, no, he's just pointing out that there's the possibility. If there was an unlocked door or a jarred door, then the intruder could have gotten in that way. I've always argued that possibly they went through the window or possibly went through a door, but I believe that the intruder was trying to leave through that window.
Mm-hmm. And I think, and Lou definitely would have agreed with you. And again, you know, having the body found in the basement, just, you know, within, I don't know how many feet from that window, the scuff mark below the window, there were some other things that, you know, led Lou to believe that that was likely the POI, the point of entry, but also the point of exit. And what Lou knew, being an experienced police officer, most burglars that commit a crime, they enter a dwelling or business through whatever, you know, a door or window, but that's the majority of the time their point of exit as well, because they're familiar with that route. You know, that's how they entered. And so most burglaries, and I don't remember the statistic, it's 80-some percent of burglars that enter a home exit through that same point of entry. So I think Lou was aware of that, but I think because the murder happened in the basement, that would have been the closest exit that the suspect was familiar with. And then that suitcase being positioned upright, Lou said, you know, and he'd crawled in and out of that window several times, said it's kind of hard to get up in the window unless you have something to stand on. And that's what he believes that was positioned like it was. And when John Ramsey walked down there, one of the first things he said was that suitcase wasn't there. You know, we didn't keep the suitcases upright, you know, underneath that window. Someone's positioned that there.
Yeah. And that's another, I think, point of argument when I've talked to this about this case with other individuals is to go, well, how would John know that? Because the house was so large. And like you pointed out, yeah, the house was large, but the basement was not a full basement. It was a mm-hmm. partial basement.
Right. Right. Yeah. If I can leave with this request, if it doesn't sound too self-serving, but people often ask when I do a talk or book signing, they say, well, how can we help? The two things that really do help with the book, as you guys know, the more Amazon reviews the book gets, the higher the ratings are. Yes. And the whole intent is to get the story out there. So if someone takes the time to read the book, would they please, you know, consider doing a review on Amazon, because that'll help get that much more exposure to the book. And then the second thing, if someone's that reads the book or listens to this program, if you have the financial ability to make a donation to the GoFundMe account, we really would appreciate it. Even if it's just $10 or $50 or whatever, it's a way of us continuing our work. Again, we're not in dire straits financially, but the more people that contribute, the more we can do. So if someone is in a position to make a donation to our GoFundMe account, none of us get paid. The money only goes to reimburse us if we have to travel or go in a hotel, and it's mostly used to pay for the DNA testing. So we're not making any money off of this, but it does help us with the expenses to continue our work.
Yes, of course. Thank you so much, Mr. Anderson, for joining us today and telling us about the great Lou Smith and his involvement in the Ramsey case and your continued involvement and your team's involvement in seeing this thing through.
Well, thank you and the captain for your time today and sharing this story.
I want to thank everybody for joining us here in the garage. If you have thoughts and opinions on this interview, share them with us at our blog at truecrimegarage.com. While you're there, check out our recommended reading page. Colonel, do we have any recommended reading for the beautiful listeners today?
Yes, we do, Captain. And of course, this week we are going to be recommending Lou and JonBenet, A Legendary Lawman's Quest to Solve a Child Beauty Queen's Murder by John Wesley Anderson, our guest that you heard here today and yesterday in the garage. Make sure you pick up his book. It's a great way to review Lou's career, Mr. Anderson's career, and then Lou Smith working and his findings on the JonBenet case. That's Lou and JonBenet. You can find that title and many other wonderful titles on our recommended page by going to our website, truecrimegarage.com.
And until next week,
be good, be kind, and don't limit.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.